I think it's safe to assume that anybody who has watched a movie or two over the years can remember that iconic blue and yellow Touchstone Pictures logo. The studio is now defunct, but the legacy of movies left behind from this label, I think, will stand the test of time. Created by Disney, Touchstone Pictures would kick off its run of production in the mid-80s, and it would pump out quality movies until they ceased operations in 2016. In this video, I'll be breaking down the Touchstone filmography from its splashy beginnings in 1984 through 1986, so let's take a ride back in cinematic time. What's up out there, guys? It's awesome to have you back. If you're new here, welcome to Movies Never Say Die. I'm Anthony DeGioia, and this is your home for 80s and 90s retro content, and Touchstone Pictures is certainly cemented in the legacy of retro cinema history. It had a few variations over the years, but when that familiar logo would scroll across the bottom of the screen, you more than likely knew you were in for an entertaining movie. But before we start diving into the studio's extensive filmography, let's quickly talk about the origins of Touchstone Pictures. Now, we all know the Disney label has always been known for kids content, and they made a pretty penny from that during the late 70s. However, that kid-friendly reputation of Disney was beginning to hurt the company at the box office in the genre that once brought them money. Kids content was now sort of boxing them in financially. Disney began tinkering with films that would hope to aim to an older audience, beginning with films like Escape to Witch Mountain in 75, as well as its sequel in 78, but these were still G-rated films, though, and they didn't bring in the returns the studio had hoped, so closing out the 70s and heading into the early 80s, Disney would continue to work on more PG-rated films under distribution deals with both Paramount Pictures and Buena Vista Distribution. This was a way for Disney to profit on adult content while still maintaining their sugary clean image for kids and parents. From the late 70s until around early 83, films like Night Crossing and Tron and Trenchcoat, Midnight Madness and The Devil and Max Devlin and others would be released, but none would move the financial needle. Disney would also co-produce Dragon Slayer and Popeye with Paramount Pictures, but neither of those films took off at the time. So between 1982 and 1983, Disney would lose in excess of $60 million from their ventures into edgier PG-rated films, which to me is where the problem existed for Disney in the first place, the fact that they considered edgier content simply meaning soft PG-rated films. And the public wasn't fooled. They never really felt this was edgy content or adult-themed content, and everybody knew Disney was still known for younger-themed movies. Just because they were coming out with these PG-rated films didn't necessarily mean they were coming out with adult-themed content. And Disney had been trying to play both sides, and it cost them a small fortune. So it was then decided they needed a new, completely different distribution brand to produce films for the grown folk. First announced in late 82, Disney VP of Productions Tom Wilhite said the studio planned to release more mature films under a completely new banner. Wilhite explained, saying this would allow them a wider latitude with mature content and different subject matter. They would still refrain from raunchy and graphic content, but the possibility of R-rated releases was never taken off the table. After a little more than a year of development, in February of 84, then-Disney CEO Ron Miller founded Touchstone Films. Now, Touchstone Films was simply a pseudonym. It was not a distinct business operation. The Touchstone Films name was just a banner. These movies would be produced on Disney's dime, and they planned to release around four movies or so a year for adult audiences under the Touchstone Films name. And with the Disney connection, the ability to amass stars to their projects came relatively easy, and they would really shoot out of the gate hot with their first movie.
My life, I've been waiting for someone, and when I find her, she's a fish.
The romantic comedy Splash would be directed by Ron Howard. Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah were in the leads. John Candy and Eugene Levy were in supporting roles, so it had all the right pieces for success. Now, to be honest, this was never really to my taste. I think it's an okay movie, but I'm certainly not as high on it as the majority. However, this tale of a dude falling in love with a mermaid captured the hearts of moviegoers. It was well received by critics. It killed it at the box office throughout the spring and into the summer, making Touchstone Films a seeming instant success. Splash would drop into theaters on March 9th, 1984 and take the number one spot with a $6.1 million weekend on only 829 screens. This movie had an impressive $7,400 per theater average, which meant the theaters were full to the max for every showing everywhere all day. Splash would spend 8 weeks in the top five and would end its theatrical run with $69.8 million on a measly $11 million budget. And this charming little story of love between Hanks and Hannah would end up being the 10th highest grossing film of the year, and it would earn an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay.
Mister, you can take our equipment and you can haul off all our stock, but when you come out to pull us off this land, you better come with more than a piece of paper.
From a widely accessible commercial hit, Touchstone Films would venture to the opposite side of the spectrum with a much smaller and more serious film called Country. This was a drama co-produced by Far West Productions and the Pangea Corporation. Country is a movie I haven't actually seen, but it was clearly Touchstone Films' attempt at dabbling with an awards film given the serious topic and the September 28th release date, which usually that time of year signifies the beginning of awards season for filmmaking. Jessica Lange starred in this movie alongside her real-life man at the time, Sam Shepard, as a rural couple fighting to keep a hold of their farm during these shifts in economic times. This was something really being experienced by American farmers in the 80s, and even President at the time, Ronald Reagan, stated that this film was blatant propaganda against government agricultural programs. Jessica Lange was actually so involved in this project that she was brought before a U.S. congressional panel to testify as an expert about living and working on family farms. Not overly intrigued, however, were the audiences. Country would get a staggered release, opening in a few major markets before getting a slow rollout, and it never really caught on with moviegoers, pulling in only $9.6 million on a $10 million budget, but Jessica Lange would get an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. However, outside of that and a few other nominations from various smaller guilds and critic circles during award season, this Jessica Lange passion project Touchstone Films had acquired from the Ladd Company did little to move the needle, quickly bringing executives back down to earth after riding the high of Splash's financial and critical success.
It's a hatchling. Look at you.
Then would come 1985, and with a new year, Touchstone Films would take things back to basics. Baby Secret of the Lost Legend would be released in late March of 1985. The story centered on a couple who discover a mother and baby brontosaurus in Africa, and of course will have to fight to protect them from violent poachers, and this heartwarming dino adventure was sadly not the crowd-pleaser Touchstone Films had hoped to kick the year off with. Baby Secret of the Lost Legend would open with a $4 million weekend, but it was also competing against The Last Dragon, Porky's Revenge, and Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, all of which opened on the weekend of the 22nd. So competition was tough, and this movie would only manage to take the number five spot at the box office. And just after 3 weeks, it was already out of the theater with a meager $14.9 million on a $13 million budget. Now, I do think this is a decent film. I enjoyed it as a kid and I watched it a ton, but what does that tell you? Touchstone was regressing back to kids' movies with adult themes, and it had failed them once again. This movie would get recut and get a new name, Dinosaur Secret of the Lost Legend, which would play on NBC's The Magical World of Disney, so I assume that's where I watched it the most when I was a kid. And this was another of those movies that just seemed to be on cable every weekend around lunchtime during the mid-80s. It's your typical emotionally driven adventure for kids. The cast is solid and the scoring from Jerry Goldsmith is perfectly calibrated to the dramatic undercurrent of the plot. The effects are naturally dated and it's a little dark in places like many kid-themed movies were during the era. And today it certainly has this nostalgia factor, but for Touchstone Films at the time, it was a financial disappointment.
I mean, this is generating power and light without heat, Michael.
How is that possible?
It's not possible.
Something that was oddly trendy with moviegoers in 1985 was the teen science fiction adventure flick. Movies like Real Genius and Weird Science and Back to the Future were white hot studio properties. So, of course, Touchstone Films wanted to get into the mix with My Science Project, a comedy adventure about a teenager who steals a piece of government equipment to use for his science project, only to realize he has something much more life-changing in his possession. Personally, I've always enjoyed this movie. I don't like it as much as the other films I just mentioned, but I do have fun with it. I think it's a charming adventure film filled with a lot of action and just 80s teen humor. The dated effects are nostalgic. That's when this movie is its most fun. But really, the problem with this one is it just came out at the wrong time. My Science Project would land in the 14th spot with just $1.5 million its opening weekend. It would just have a two-week run before getting pulled, bringing in just $4.1 million on an $8 million budget. Released on August 9th, this movie really did face some serious competition, though. It had Summer Rental, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and coincidentally Real Genius to deal with its opening weekend. Then there was other recently released films like Back to the Future, Weird Science, Fright Night, and National Lampoon's European Vacation to contend with. So despite the traffic, this was another miss for Touchstone Films. As we already know, Touchstone was a division of Disney, and there was a lot of corporate movement in the early 80s. Walt Disney had passed in 66, Roy Disney had passed in 71, and with Ron Miller in charge, the company had lost millions of dollars and barely survived a series of takeover attempts. Stockholders were naturally displeased with where the company was going, so it was announced that a change would be made. Miller was given the boot, and Paramount CEO Michael Eisner was brought in to take the new CEO position in 1985. He believed in taking chances to achieve success. He built a team around himself to turn Disney and subsequently Touchstone Films around, because it was clear that the Touchstone venture was pretty much sputtering out of the gate so far outside of Splash's success. Now, Eisner's first year in charge was a little rough at the cinema. 1985 was another crappy year business-wise, but to his credit, he had just gotten there, and all of these projects had been in motion prior to his hiring, but there were some movements behind the scenes, though. Disney would form a partnership with E.F. Hutton, an investment firm, and Silver Screen Partners II would be formed as a medium to raise over $150 million for future films. This money would be split between Disney and Touchstone projects, with Eisner projecting around 4 movies per year from Disney and around 8 to 10 movies per year from the Touchstone label. So naturally, with that many projects, the budgets would need to be manageable, which is something that we'll get into a little bit deeper here in a second.
Barbara, is that the new pool man?
Hey!
Call 911!
1986 would begin, and Eisner and his team were already at work with the first film to be released under their regime and the first R-rated movie to come from under the Disney umbrella. Down and Out in Beverly Hills, starring Nick Nolte, Bette Midler, and Richard Dreyfuss. This movie centered on a highly dysfunctional rich couple that saves a homeless man who tries to drown himself in their pool. This movie is just wildly humorous. The premise is simple. It's unique. The performances go all in on these eccentric characters. And I remember watching this movie so many times as a kid on cable. I think the writing is so sharp-witted and clever here, and with the team of Dreyfuss, Midler, and Nolte, there is no shortage of charisma and personality. This is a movie that's absurd in all the silly ways you would hope from a parody on socialite life, and audiences dug it. Down and Out in Beverly Hills would hit theaters on January 31st, taking the number one spot with a $5.7 million opening weekend, dethroning The Color Purple from the top position and beating out other movies opening that weekend, such as Youngblood and The Best of Times. Down and Out would spend 4 weeks in the number one spot, 7 weeks in the top five, and it would end its box office run with $62.1 million on just a $14 million budget. So with this first film under Eisner leadership, Touchstone Pictures was sitting on another box office hit, and to me, this is when the Touchstone brand would really begin to take off. 1986 would be a big year for Touchstone Films. They would release 4 more movies. As I said, Down and Out was made for just $14 million, and it was because Eisner had a methodology to keeping his budgets down. He would target stars either fading from popularity, just on the rise, or those dealing with legal issues that would work for cheap. Also in 1986, he signed a five-year deal with Showtime for exclusive airing rights, a deal reportedly worth well up into the nine figures for all of Touchstone's movies to be aired on Showtime and the Movie Channel. So things were starting to change for the label as they finally stepped into what the majority of the world considered teen and adult targeted movies, something it appeared Eisner actually knew the definition of. It wasn't the 50s anymore, it was the 80s. People were spending money, having recreational sex, blowing through coke, partying, moving out to the suburbs and starting families, and they wanted to see movies that represented those things.
Patrolman Abraham Washington from the 22nd Precinct.
Not the 22nd. We never say the 22nd. It's the 22.
Just a few months after the release of Down and Out, Touchstone would release their next movie, a small comedy called Off Beat, starring Judge Reinhold, Meg Tilly, John Turturro, John Montagna, and Harvey Keitel. The fun plot in this one revolves around a young man who poses as a cop for his buddy who was selected to do a dance performance and, of course, ends up falling in love and getting roped up in a bunch of silly comical hijinks. Now, I'll be honest, I completely forgot about this movie until making this video. I had to go back and rewatch it again. I remember watching it on cable so many times when I was a kid. I was always a big fan of Judge Reinhold and felt like this movie just was always playing during the weekends on the late mornings. Off Beat would open on April 11th. It would take the number 5 spot with a decent $2 million weekend right in between Band in the Hand and Critters that also opened. It would only pull in $4.1 million on a $10 million budget though, so it certainly wasn't a movie that banked for Touchstone. But as I said, I watched it on cable countless times now, to which I can assume was either Showtime and the Movie Channel. It was relatively well received from critics, but just never really took off.
Don't you consider throwing a body off a cliff in the dead of night?
She'll be unconscious.
Just 2 months later, Touchstone Films would release its next movie, and instantly the studio would have another bona fide hit on their hands with Ruthless People, starring Danny DeVito, Bette Midler, Helen Slater, Judge Reinhold, and Bill Pullman in his first feature film. This wildly fun comedy is centered on a clothing manufacturer who originally plans to kill his wife to inherit a fortune, but discovers that she's already been kidnapped by a couple that he stole a garment design from when he goes to attempt his plan. Ruthless People would drop into theaters in the middle of the summer on June 27th of 86, and it would take the number 4 spot with a $5.2 million weekend. Not a bad spot, I think, given the competition that it had for movies like The Karate Kid 2, Back to School, and the biggest summer movie that year, Top Gun, which was just vacuuming up a bulk of the summer box office profitability. Ruthless People, however, though, was a textbook example of why sometimes it's just as beneficial to have legs at the theater rather than having that quick burst for a few weeks only to flatline after. Ruthless People would spend 5 weeks in the box office top 5, it would spend a total of 15 weeks in the top 10, and it would close out its theatrical run with $71.6 million on just a $13 million budget. Michael Eisner's hire cheap philosophy was working. Midler was signed to a multi-picture arrangement deal after the success of Down and Out, and the studio passed on Jack Nicholson for the lead role in this one due to his $4 million salary demand, which turned out to be a great decision. They saved some money, and DeVito and Midler were such a charming duo for this simple premise. They made this movie, and they also helped make what would end up being a comedic gem that would also end up being the ninth highest grossing movie on the worldwide box office list in 1986. With Ruthless People still charming audiences on the big screen, Touchstone's next movie would be released on the first weekend of October. However, there would be a slight change this time around. Ruthless People would actually be the last movie to be released under the Touchstone Films name. Earlier, Eisner and his team had lobbied for a name change. They'd done so for several months. Their initial recommendation was to change the name to Hollywood Pictures. This is actually a studio label that would come to fruition later in 1989, but at the time it was not voted in. I assume that they didn't want such a drastic name change after only a few years into existence, so it was decided that all future movies would be released as Touchstone Pictures.
Never met so many stupid people in one day. ugly, too.
The crime comedy Tough Guys would feature a couple of Hollywood legends when Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas would team up to play a couple of old gangsters who are released from a 30-year prison stint, only to find the world is completely changed, except for the ability to get in trouble, which remains just the same. Now, I remember bits and pieces of this movie from seeing it playing on TV here and there over the years. I had never actually watched it from start to finish until I made this video, and when I did so, I had a blast. I loved the skillful delivery of the humor, the adventurous plot is fun, and the charm of Lancaster and Douglas as a couple of golden era tough guys dropped into a modern world is just great comedy. Tough Guys would drop into theaters on October 3rd of 86 to take the number 2 spot with a $4.6 million weekend, but nothing was beating Crocodile Dundee on its second weekend in the number 1 place, where it would spend another 7 weeks. As for Tough Guys, it was able to find its audience. This was the 7th movie Lancaster and Douglas had done together. They had been making movies together since the late 40s. They were known as being somewhat of a team during their era, so there's no doubt their final pairing here in Tough Guys was able to give this movie a built-in section of the audience. It would spend 5 weeks in the top 5 and go on to earn a respectable $21.5 million on a $10 million budget, giving Touchstone Pictures another film in the green under their belt. So as you can see, Touchstone Pictures was having a great year with 2 sizable box office hits. There were only a few months left in 1986, but Touchstone Pictures would have one last movie to close out their year. There had been a little sequel being shopped around in Hollywood at the time, but it wasn't getting any bites. Columbia Pictures passed on it, as did 20th Century Fox. Touchstone Pictures liked the project, they would greenlight its production, and when they did so, Touchstone Pictures would officially have their first awards film.
You've got a sledgehammer break.
25 years ago, I had the screws put on me. I mean, it was over for me before it really got started.
Martin Scorsese's sequel to The Hustler, The Color of Money, starring Paul Newman, Tom Cruise, and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, would be the next release to come out from Touchstone Pictures. Newman would reprise his role as Fast Eddie Felsen, who takes this new young pool prodigy under his wing to make some money hustling and winning tournaments, and the result to me is just a timeless classic. I absolutely love this movie. I think it's just soaked with atmosphere and great performances and pristine direction. It just made pool cool, with billiard rooms across the country suddenly filling up after this movie's release. The Color of Money would drop into theaters on October 17th to take the number 2 spot with a solid $6.4 million weekend, with that damn Crocodile Dundee still in the number 1 spot in its 4th week. The Color of Money would spend 7 weeks in the top 5. It would finish its theatrical run with $52.3 million on just a $14.5 million budget. The critics were high on this movie. Audiences enjoyed it as well. The Color of Money would get 4 Oscar nominations, and Paul Newman would get his first Academy Award for Best Actor. This would wrap up the year for Touchstone Pictures, and you would have to say the impression of Michael Eisner on the Touchstone side of his Disney CEO position was a success. Disney had officially been able to create films that were able to connect with teen and adult audiences. Touchstone also had its deal with Showtime, and funding their films was solidified with Silver Screen Partners too, so all was looking bright. However, just because Touchstone had released all their movies for the year didn't mean there was one last business deal to get done before 1986. Silver Screen Partners, which had raised $200 million for the 85 and 86 film slates, would enter into one of the largest film underwriting ventures in history when they would attempt to raise $300 million for a proposed 18 movie split between Disney and Touchstone. And they would get it. Touchstone would officially kick off its original production schedule. 87 would see 9 movies. 88 would deliver 10 movies, with 8 more in 89. And many of these are timeless classics from the 80s that will never go out of style. And that's it for this video, guys. I really do hope you guys have enjoyed this little look back at the early years of Touchstone Pictures. Let me know what you think of these movies. What are some of your favorite movies from Touchstone Pictures? I'd love to hear your guys' opinions and preferences. I'll be diving into Touchstone's film releases from 1987 in a video coming up real soon. I hope to see you guys all back for that one. And until then, movies never say die.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Survive a war, you gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?